g'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth2u.org. Don't forget to sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can also keep up to date via iTunes and Facebook and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, Ira.
G'day, Jono. You sound so much better, Jono. You sound like you have life in you again.
I feel so much better. I was disgusting last week, Ira. I was just so revolting. I won't go into detail. As much as you would like me to, you always like to focus on those parts of the book
of
Job.
Did you feel like Job at all?
I just was so gross. Oh, it was disgusting, but I feel a lot better. Thank you, my friend.
Well, that's good. People were disappointed that we weren't able to put anything out last week. Yeah,
I know. So we're up to Job chapter. Hey, listen, by the way, Boca Raton, is there some sort of political showdown there tonight?
Yeah, actually the debate is going on tonight in Boca Raton, and I was just down there, and I got to tell you a funny story about that.
Go on.
We went down to visit family for the weekend. It was actually my mother's 89th birthday last week.
Wow, g'day Ira's mum.
So we were, she was out of town for her birthday, but we went down to see her this past weekend, and we had a wonderful time, and we had to go down and visit some other family for lunch on Sunday. And as we were driving down, my mother and my sister lived just north of Boca Raton. So we were driving down on the Florida Turnpike, and we started laughing because there was this billboard. And Lori was like, quick, I got to get my camera. And she was trying to fumble with her phone to try and take a picture, but we couldn't do it. And then we were trying to do it on the way back. So anyway, Boca Raton is decidedly a very Jewish area, upscale Jewish area in Florida. Mm-hmm. And a billboard said, Obama, oy vey, have you had enough?
Oh, I've seen it. I saw it on Facebook. Someone took a photo of it.
That was me.
Oh, it was you. You put it up there. You had to do it.
Me and I put it up there. Because I thought that was really funny. And so there were a couple of these billboards actually on 95 as well, which is another north-south road that goes actually up through Florida all the way up to the northeast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems like they're targeting some of the Jewish areas with these, Jewish billboards.
Sure.
So it was pretty
there
fun.
You go.
So that's what's happening in Boca tonight.
Well, g'day to everybody listening in Florida. Boca Tov to those in Boca Raton, which according to you, Ira, is the mouth of the rat, is that right?
The mouth of the rat.
Joy of joys.
That's yeah, and there's a joke we always, there's a whole group of guys down in South Florida that always, you know, rather saying Boca Tov, they say Boca Raton.
So g'day to everybody listening in Florida. Now, we are up to Job chapter 15, and as you pointed out last time we spoke, it is the second round, and the first person to speak, of course, of Job's mates was Eliphaz, and Eliphaz sort of was, you know, put on the gloves and sort of gently had a go at Job. Now he's taking the gloves off, right?
Yeah. So you know what's happened is each of the friends, Eliphaz and Bildad and so far, they actually I think believe that they were trying to help Job in his travail. And it seems like from Job's responses that either he didn't hear what they were saying, or the things that he heard really had little or no impact on him at all. Mm. And as we get into the second speech of Eliphaz, it seemed that, like you said, he was really kind of giving Job what we call the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But what we see now is, well, you know, like, the gloves are off and he's ready to, he's ready to go because he has listened to Job answer him and he's listened to Job answer the two other friends.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And during this whole time, maintaining his innocence and insisting on taking God to court, on legal terms.
Yeah. And we're talking about chapters 12 and 13, of course, Job, offers up his own defense, and this is what Eliphaz is responding to.
Right, and Eliphaz now almost sounds like he changes his position from speaking to a friend who he knows is going through a terrible time and is kind of, you know, gently kind of shadow boxing with him.
Mm-hmm.
But now he actually is speaking to Job as if he's dealing with somebody who he considers to be wholly wicked.
Oh, look, he just picks up the baseball bat, goes in and just starts slamming into the poor guy. I mean, here he is, covered in sores, restless in pain and agony, having lost all of his family, his possessions and everything, and he's lying in the dust in some sort of leprous mess. And then here's Eliphaz, all of a sudden, in chapter 15, picks up the baseball bat, jumps in, and starts pounding him. And it begins like this.
Then wait, Eliphaz, there's two interesting things that we got to say before we get into the verses, though, and that's this. When you listen to some of the things that are said here, it appears that one or two things happens. It appears that either Eliphaz has not been listening to anything that Job answers so far. And the reason I say that is because we're going to see him echo thoughts and words that Job has already presented in an argument.
Mm. He's definitely taking the words of Job and using them back against him and distorting his own words and hitting him with it. So he has been hearing the words of Job, but has he been understanding what Job is saying?
Right. And then this is the other thing. I mean, have you ever sat in a courtroom? Have you ever been part of a trial?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do you ever watch how the lawyer sits there sometimes and he seems like he's not paying attention?
Yes.
But the whole time he's writing down on his legal pad.
Yep.
And he makes notes so that he can bring his points point by point and tick them off as he goes through them. And I think this is what we're getting ready to see this with Eliphaz.
He says, Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "Should a wise man answer with empty knowledge?" Strike number one, empty knowledge. "And fill himself with the east wind." And the east wind, of course, is the hot, dry wind. And so, I mean, they've already said to Job, "Hey, you're full of hot air. You know, you're full of hot air." But this, I mean, east wind really exaggerates that point. And fill himself with the east wind. "Should he reason with unprofitable talk or by speeches with which he can do no good?" So useless speeches. So you've got useless speeches, unprofitable talk. You're full of hot air, violent hot air, and empty knowledge. "Yes, you cast off fear and restrain prayer before God. Your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, and not I. Yes, your own lips testify against you." And I mean, there's an example, right? Because if we go back to chapter 9, verse 20, Job actually says that. He uses those words. He says, "Though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. And though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse. But I am blameless, yet I do not know myself." And he goes on and he explains, but the context is not there in what Eliphaz is taking. He's taking his words and distorting them and throwing them back at Job, right?
Right. So what did you say in verse 2? Knowledge of what?
I've got, "Should a wise man answer with empty knowledge?"
Right. Actually, it says, da'at ruach, knowledge of wind. "Should a wise man answer with knowledge of wind and fill his belly with the east wind," which you said. And then, you know, I'm giving you the English, and people often, just so people know, often I get, emails or, you know, people, will write on Truth to You or on Treasures from the Tanakh Facebook page, and they'll say, "What version are you using?" And so when I translate this and my translation is different than what Jonah's reading, it's not that I'm using a different translation. What I'm doing is translating literally from what the Hebrew says. Yeah. So I'm taking a Hebrew translation and translating into English here. Mm-hmm. So verse 3 says, "Should he argue with words that are not useful, or with a speech that is not profitable?" And where it gets really interesting is in verse 4, because in the English translation, I would translate it as, "Indeed, you do away with reverence and hinder meditation before God."
And that is a better, that makes sense, verse 4.
Right. Yeah, okay. And so these words in verse 4, we see af ata tafer. And this word tafer can mean to break, to destroy, to suspend, to make useless, or to declare invalid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost saying that you're invalidating. And then this word, where it goes on, it says yira v'tigra sicha, and that word sicha can mean meditation, and I translated it that way in the English. But it can also mean or be related to conversation as it relates to a discourse of wisdom, which makes it interesting based on the fact that, of course, we're talking about these guys who are supposed to be from the East. We see that East wind. Mm-hmm. We see this reference to wisdom again. They're men from the East, and they're supposed to be men of great wisdom. And so basically, this sums up the beginning of the speech. Because he's reminding Job that people will hear you, and since you were considered a very wise man, will be subverting the awe in which people stand before God. In other words, this idea of kind of taking God to court as if man could stand there and take God to court in a legal manner, basically you're invalidating the awe of God. Mm-hmm. And the way people view God and how they stand before God.
Mm-hmm. And so this is the way that he begins, and he begins hard.
And sure, and then because your iniquity teaches your mouth in verse 5, and you choose the tongue of the crafty or the tongue of the cunning. And that's really interesting because you mentioned that, you know, in about what Job related back.
Yep, 9:20, yep.
Right, but what's really interesting is the word that's used at the end there when it says, in the Hebrew it says, Ki ye'alef avoncha picha v'tivcha leshon arumim. And leshon arumim is this idea of the tongue of the cunning. And arumim is the same word that describes the nachash. In Genesis 3:1.
Yeah, in Genesis, that's right.
In Genesis, when it says, V'hanachash haya arum. Okay.
And the interesting thing about that is because there is that reference or that connection at least back to the garden. And then in verse 7, he begins with, are you the first man who was born? Or were you made before the hills? And so here we are in creation and the creation of Adam. And he seems to, it's as if he's reminding Job, listen, I know everything from right from the beginning all the way to now. I don't write me off. I've got knowledge too. I have wisdom as well, and it extends right to the very beginning.
Right, and this is where we see this is where we. I mean, come on, he's comparing in essence. You know, he's almost comparing, you know, Job to the Nachash, to the serpent. You know, calling him cunning in the way he's trying to speak. But I think where we see the real lack of compassion that comes out on the part of Eliphaz here is that, and we have to be careful that when we go through this, that we don't lose sight of the fact of what Job has been going through. Mm-hmm. Because it's really easy now, just in these back and forth dialogues, that we forget, and I won't say it because I know you don't like me to talk about what Job is going through, but we tend to forget what's really driving him in this. Mm-hmm. And we really have to question sometimes, especially when we see this repetition and sometimes we see this contradiction and repetition. He'll say one thing and then we'll see, you know, a chapter or two later that it almost sounds like he's saying the complete opposite. And so we have to remember what the guy's going through and wonder whether or not sometimes is he actually speaking in his right mind. We can't imagine what kind of pain and suffering this guy's going through.
And yet it is amazing that he is able, I mean, in the same way that Eliphaz here in this chapter 15 is taking Job's words, distorting them and throwing them back at Job, we see that Job also takes note of what his so-called friends are saying to him in chapters 12 and 13 and does repeat a little bit back to them. And we see the same thing, and we'll see this next week when we do 16 and 17, he does a little bit of that again. So, I can appreciate that he's lacking in quality sleep, and that definitely would impair his ability to think clearly. And yet, we still do see an incredible amount of comprehension and understanding. But it's certainly something to take into consideration.
Sure. So, and then in verse 6, where you kind of left off, where it says your mouth causes you to be condemned, and not I. And your lips, they answer to you. We have to remember that in Eliphaz's first speech, he never really condemned Job. Mm. And he makes this statement in verse 6 just before he's getting ready to ask Job a series of questions. And if we remember back in Job chapter 13, verse 23, Job actually asks God, how many are my iniquities and sins? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Make known to me my transgression and my sin. And then Eliphaz tells him, your mouth condemns you and your lips testify against you. Mm-hmm. And then he goes into this series of questions.
And the series of questions begin, as I mentioned, back in creation, the theme there. But it's so sarcastic. I mean, obviously,
that's terrible.
The answer to every single question is no. But it begins with this: are you the first man who was born, or were you made before the hills? Have you heard the counsel of God? Do you limit wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that is not in us? Both the gray-haired and the aged among us, much older than your father, are with us. Okay, so let me read that again. Verse 10, both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, as if to say, hey, listen, we got people who are even older than us that we've discussed this with before we even left. And in our circles of wisdom back home, they agree with us. As if we have put you on trial before we even left, and we know what's going on even before we got on our camel and came here.
Yep, sure. Amen. So, first of all, I have to apologize to the listeners because I have this really squeaky chair, and I don't know if it's coming across to you, but I did a show the other day on radio, and the guys were like, what the heck is that noise that you're making there?
No, but you see, I edit out the squeaky chair. Everyone's going, what?
Do you?
What squeaky chair? Yeah.
What squeaky chair? Okay. All right. Well, so when we look at this idea that you talked about, the creation, he's basically saying to him in verse 7, were there no human beings born before you? Or another interpretation could be, were you born before Adam so that there's nobody with wisdom like yours?
Mm.
And some say that this is actually an answer to a comment that Job made to Zophar when he alludes to his youth and lack of wisdom in Job chapter 12:12, when he says, is wisdom in the aged and understanding in length of days?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And then in the second part of the verse, or were you brought forth before the hills? This actually refers back to one of my favorite chapters in Mishlei in Proverbs, mm-hmm. in Proverbs 8:25, when it says, before the mountains were settled, before the hills, I was brought forth. You know, it's talking about the wisdom. And there in 8:25, it's talking about the Torah, actually.
Sure.
It's talking about wisdom, and actually that's the one that speaks about chokhmah. Mm-hmm. And we see that in Job 12:12 when it says, "Bishishim chokhmah ve'orech yamim tivruna," you know, is wisdom in the age and understanding in the length of days. Mm-hmm. He says, in the secret counsel of God, have you listened and reduced wisdom to yourself? So again, he's saying, you know, what is with you? Like, you think you're the only one that has wisdom? What do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that we do not? And then back in chapter 12, we see this again when we see where it says, truly you are the people, and with you wisdom will die.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that in verse 12 as well. It says, also to me is a heart or a mind like you, and I am not inferior to you who does not know such things. Mm. And so we see that going back and forth, where there's this constant this back and forth thing about whether or not, you know, what do you know? You're just a youngster when Job's answering him. And then, of course, in the verse 10 where you said it all. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Ira, it does make you think, it makes me think, that really maybe perhaps the motivation behind these guys coming to, I was going to say console Job, but obviously that hasn't happened.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Them fronting up to Job is more about the tall poppy syndrome. That is to say that they wanted to come and almost gloat over him to make themselves look grander and wiser and better off, because he was, as we established in the opening chapters, regarded as a king and a wise man in his area. And it's as if they've come to pit themselves against him. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that argument can be made based on how we interpret verse 10, where it says, also gray-haired, also the aged are with us. Mighty from your father's days.
Mighty from your father. I've got much older than your father. You've got mighty from your father's days, right?
Okay. Yeah, if I look at it in Hebrew, that's how I would interpret it.
Interesting.
And so I think what's happening here is basically what they're saying is there are those among us that are older than even your father. And so if you want to make the argument that some of us are too young to counsel you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that this is an answer to maybe the question of whether or not he has the ability to hear from younger people, and that could be an issue sometime. I mean, of course, we can't forget that Job was considered and could possibly have been, you know, one of the kings of the East.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also something to be said for the fact that sometimes we are too prideful to be able to hear from anybody that's younger than us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it certainly does say to me, verse 10 certainly says to me that what little information they had in their back in their own cities, they took that information, they held counsel with the wise men there. They judged according to the information that they had, made up their mind, and really the verdicts had been declared even before they got on their camels. They had just traveled the distance to tell Job, you know, you tripped up, but it's okay, we haven't, and we're here to tell you that we haven't.
Yeah, and the truth is we don't know the time frame here. We don't know how long a period this is. We don't know if these, you know, these dialogues are going on, you know, chronologically one after the other. We don't know if there's a break in this. We don't know if, you know, all of them stayed there this entire time. You know, there's possible, who knows? It's possible that servants could have been going back and forth. It's possible that any one of them could have gone back and forth. Because remember, at the beginning, we can't really hang our hat on any, I mean, remember, we talked about Job in the beginning, that it's so difficult to hang our hat on where he came from.
Mm-hmm.
We have perspectives and the possibility that he could have come from somewhere as close as an area of what, you know, would have been what's today in Jordan, which would have been very close to the area that they're in now. And he could have come as far away from, the area of Mesopotamia, let's say. So it's very possible that there could have been a short ride for them to go back and to discuss what was going on with Job to other elders and other wise men.
Mm-hmm.
And come back.
So it continues.
We just don't know.
Are the consolations of God too small for you and the words spoken gently with you? Have you got gently with you in verse 11?
Well, actually, I would read it, are the consolations of God too few for you and gentle words with you?
And gentle words with you. Why does your heart carry you away? And what do your eyes wink at that you should turn your spirit against God and let such words go out from your mouth?
Hmm. Yeah. So when we look back at when we're looking back at verse 11, where we just, you know, kind of had a little bit difference in the way it's translated, that word for actually it says, Hamat mimcha tanchumot el vedavar laat imach, and it's actually this tanchumat is related to comfort, and I think what's being said here in verse 11 is what he's basically starting to say is you had a good when you were good, but now that you're wicked. He goes on and he says, what takes your heart away and what winks your eyes?
Mm. So what your heart has carried you away and what do you wink your eyes at? So he's suggesting deceitfulness?
Yeah. So one of the rabbinic interpretations of this is that it's to what straits have your sufferings brought you? How can your eyes flash with such arrogance?
Oh,
that's a rabbinic interpretation of that verse.
Okay.
So in other words, why are you letting your heart dictate your thoughts?
Mm-hmm.
And why are you questioning the providence of God?
Mm. That you turn your spirit against God and let such words go out of your mouth. What is man that he could... Now, here we go. Eliphaz is a Calvinist, Ira. You ready for this? Have a go at this.
Yeah.
What is man that he could be pure and he who is born of woman, that he could be righteous. If God puts no trust in his saints, I've got in my New King James, and the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less who is abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water? There you go. He's a Calvinist.
You know, so Calvinist, huh? You know, what's funny is, you know, having grown up in Orthodox Judaism, sometimes I have no clue of the things that people say. So when they say, you know, when they say things like Calvinism and things like that, I was actually at a conference one time, and I was listening to the guy, and it was so funny because the guy that was standing up front was wearing a kippah, and he was wearing tzitzit, and by all appearances, he was, you know, he was definitely what you would consider. I guess you would consider a messianic, and somebody that knew me in the room texted me on my phone and said, "This guy's a Calvinist," and I said, "What does that mean?" And he said, and he made it worse because then he texted me back and he says he's talking about tulip, and I said,
"There you go, yeah."
He's talking about tulip. I don't see any flowers. What the heck is a tulip? And then my friend had to explain it to me. So, you know, you might want to explain. Maybe there's other people like me out there who might want to explain what you mean by that in relation to that verse. Do you want to go there?
Do we want to go to the tulip of Calvin? 5 points of Calvinism. It takes.
So I'm assuming Calvin was like one of the.
He was one of the reformers.
Okay.
As anti-Semitic as the rest of them, of course.
Okay.
But the 5 points of Calvinism. The first one, T for tulip, is total depravity.
Total
depravity.
We're going to have to talk about that one day.
Personification of evil is every single man.
Talk about this already in Job chapter 2 and 3?
We probably did.
Okay.
Referring to every part, the essence of the human being. Every person is the personification of evil, and there's nothing about us that is redeemable, that we are, you know, it's the fall of man into sin, and it's not just sin, it's everything. Everything about us just hates God, and we're totally depraved. That's what the T stands for. All the rest of the tulip was, has to do with unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and what was the other one? Perseverance of the saints.
Wait a minute, were you a Calvinist?
No, well, actually, no, it's an interesting thing. Back in 1942, my great-grandfather, Shmuel Wurzheimer, Jewish man, but he married a Protestant, and in that day in Hungary, in Budapest, it was the Protestantism was Calvinism, I do believe, and predominantly, and he married her, and in their marriage agreement, they were married by a priest, and in the marriage contract, he had to stipulate that his children would be brought up in the mother's faith. Of course, that was my grandfather, and so he was brought up in the Calvinist faith. Indeed, his brother became a Calvinist minister. But my grandfather made it out to Italy at the time of the Second World War. Actually, it wasn't 42 when my great-grandfather got married. It was a little bit before then. He changed his name in 42. In fact, I do believe he formally converted his faith from Judaism to Protestantism, which was probably Calvinism. It's a long and interesting story, the way that my grandfather, however, got out of Hungary, went to Italy, got on a boat as the war broke out and made it out here. It's a long story. But I am familiar with Calvinism, and I did study it in the theology college that I went to.
Ah, okay. So that I was wondering how come you knew so much about that. So I didn't know, and then my friend had to text me about that, and he basically told me that what this guy had just said, you know, just sounded like, you know, Calvinism, that what is it, something about election or something like that?
Yeah, unconditional election.
Oh, unconditional, yeah, because he was saying that, you know, I guess it was the – yeah, I don't even know what that means, but okay. So anyway, back to Job.
But there it is. But Eliphaz, in any case, when we're talking about total depravity, here he is again. What is man that he could be pure And he who is born of a woman, that he could be righteous. If God puts no trust in his saints and the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less man who is abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water. There it is.
Yeah. So when he says to him in verse 13 that you turn your spirit toward God and allow such speech from your mouth, we have to remember that in context again that Eliphaz is answering Job's last speech. Mm-hmm. And as we saw in 13:18, Job says, "Behold, now I've prepared my case because I know myself to be just." Mm-hmm. And then in verse 19, "Who is he that would contend with me? Because now I would be silenced and pass away or expire." He says, if I don't present my case. And how do we know that he's alluding to this? Because we see in verse 14, when it says, "What is man that he is pure, or who is born of a woman that he should be righteous?" We see this word in the Hebrew. It says, "Ma enosh ki yizkeh." And this comes from the right, the root, I'm sorry, this word yizkeh. That's the problem with trying to speak English and Hebrew at the same time. My tongue gets tied sometimes. It actually comes from the root to be right or to be entitled. Uh-huh. In other words, this idea of when it says, "What is man that he is pure?" It actually comes from this idea of being entitled or to be right. And in the PL form of the verb, it can actually mean to acquit. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it could be read like this: "What is man that he is right or entitled? One born of a woman that he is just or made right."
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of gives that whole context of that the case again.
Mm-hmm.
"Behold, he puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight." We see that he already brought this argument in his first speech. In chapter 4, verse 17 and 18, he says, "Is man more righteous than Eloah, than his maker? Is a man more pure? See, in his servants he does not trust, and to his messengers or angels, the Malachim, he attributes error." So we see that this is, again, him bringing the same type of argument that he already brought in his first speech in Job chapter 4, verse 17 and 18.
Let me just, because off the top of my head, I can't think of it, but perhaps you can direct me to a cross-reference for verse 15. What is Eliphaz basing this on as far as we have references in the Tanakh? The God puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight. What do we base that on? What does he base that on? Is that supportable?
You know, it's a good question, and something that I haven't, you know, I didn't think about. And
because my point is, I, off the top of my head, I can't think of a verse to support that. And just because it's here and Eliphaz is saying it, just because it appears in the Tanakh, because, you know, of course, in the tradition that I come from, Ira, we're quite used to just picking out a verse and going, there it is, it says it in the Bible, therefore it's true, not looking at the context. But this is just an example that here is a case where a man is speaking in response to what Job has said, and of course we know where Job lies. He doesn't know. He doesn't have the grand wider picture that we're privy to. He speaks these things, and of course, they're not necessarily correct. Verse 15 is a good example of that, I think. I'd be interested in if the listeners have a cross reference for that. Is what Eliphaz is saying supportable? Verse 15.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at the Hebrew because there's actually a Kari Kativ here. You know, in the second word, Biktoshav, which is the translated as, you know, the holy ones.
Yeah, but look at that, because as you pointed out, 4:18, Eliphaz says it the first time that he speaks. If he puts no trust in his servants and he charges his angels with error, how much more those who dwell in houses of clay, and so on and so forth. But where's the cross reference for that as well? So that's 4:18.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look. I'm actually going to have to look up, you know, some cross references on that. Mm. And I don't want to say something that doesn't make sense. I don't want to question, you know, back and forth of, you
but
know.
But off the top of your head and off the top of my head, nothing comes to mind.
Yeah, not off the top of my head.
Okay. All right. We'll see what
looks like. I'm not going to get any. Looks like I'm not going to get any sleep tonight.
So it goes on to say, well, hang on. Before verse 16, did you have a comment there?
Well, it says, how much less one who is detestable and corrupt, man who drinks iniquity like water. So, so here we are halfway, and it's now, because remember, he just asked questions. So now he begins his speech.
Man drinks iniquity like water. Is there a cross-reference for that?
I don't believe there is.
Off the top of my head, I can't think of one either. I mean, I know that in we were in Proverbs just a little while ago, in Proverbs chapter 19, verse 28. Let me just turn there. Okay.
While you're doing that, I am going to open up a commentary.
Go on.
On chapter 15 and see what they have to say about verse 15.
You do that. This is what it says in Proverbs 19:28. A disreputable witness scorns justice, and the mouth of the wicked, Ira, the mouth of the wicked devours iniquity. Now, what Eliphaz is saying in verse 16 is man in general is what he's conveying, is abominable and filthy, or as you said, detestable and what was it?
Detestable and corrupt.
Detestable and corrupt, or abominable and filthy is what I've got. Who drinks iniquity like water. So man in general drinks iniquity like water, but Proverbs tells us that the mouth of the wicked devours iniquity. And so it's qualified here in Proverbs, but it's generic here in Job. So I'm just pointing out, 15 and 16 I don't think can be supported, and I think that Eliphaz is making some very wide statements. And I say this because I've heard in so many sermons in my earlier tradition where people would quote this, that man drinks iniquity like water, we drink iniquity like water, but they're quoting Eliphaz, and what does Eliphaz base it on? Anyway.
So here's one cross-reference that I think is I just found in one of the commentaries, that perhaps Psalm 53:4. Which says Kulo sag yachdav ne'elachu ne'elachu ein osetov ein gam echad.
God looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. Every one of them is turned aside. They have altogether become corrupt. There is none who does good, no, not one.
Right. And so I'm just giving you a perspective that this is potentially I'm trying to see what Rashi says on this.
Okay.
The same contrast is evident in the descriptions contained in verse 15 of our chapter and verse 18 of chapter 4, respectively. It says, the vision, which had a more measured perception of man's lowliness, is less lavish in its praise. Servants is more more restrained than holy ones, and so too is the use of angels when contrasted with the very heavens where the hosts of the heavens, the angels, are meant. The explanation is simple enough. In the vision, the point is being made that God must look upon even the most righteous human being as falling short of perfection. True, but God has no need to exaggerate the differences between mortals and immortals. That difference is real enough without embellishment. By contrast, in the argument, Eliphaz is demanding that Eov himself realize the enormity of the conceit that he might summon God to stand before a bar of justice. Eliphaz's point is strengthened by taking the poles of his contrast to their absolute extremes. And then it goes on. The differences between verse 16 of our chapter and verse 19 of chapter 4 is self-explanatory. In the vision, the point is to demonstrate that man, by the very limitations imposed by his physical reality, must fall short of perfection. It is not only his actual sins which are germane, but his propensity to sin. Thus, the important thing is to underline that he is forced to live his life in houses of clay. And this concept is embellished in verses 20 and 21. But in the argument, it serves Eliphaz's purpose to stress the actual sinfulness of man. And this requires no further embellishment to drive home the futility of the Eov's fantastic illusion.
Fantastic illusion.
So that's That's one of the rabbinic that's just a commentary, rabbinic commentary on those verses. So what they're saying is basically that what he's doing is he's giving extreme examples to make his point, in contrast to what he said in verse 17 and 18. He's giving these extreme examples to talk about the futility of, you know, of what Job is doing, these fantastic illusions of bringing God before a bar of justice.
It's an interesting thing also, Ira, that, and we will get to this eventually, of course, chapter 34, Elihu does make a connection to the verse that we just read, 15, verse 16. In 34, verse 7, what man is like Job who drinks scorn like water? Not iniquity, but scorn. And right. Clearly the scorn of his friends. And Job makes he makes that statement too, that he has to put up with the scorn of his friends in the following chapters. But we will get there eventually. So it's interesting. It's an interesting couple of verses, 15 and 16. All righty. So it goes
I don't know if that helped us.
it'd be interesting to hear from the listeners. If they have any comments to make, you can certainly leave them on this post, and we would be interested in reading those. 17, I will tell you, don't you love this? You know, oh, man. The people, I mean, you must come across them all the time. I do. I come across them all the time. Those who stand out in front and declare with a loud voice, I am the one who knows. I am the one. Come to me and I will give you the knowledge. The secret knowledge lies with me. I am the one. That just reminds me of this. And he says, I will tell you, hear me. What I have seen, I will declare. What wise men have told, not hiding anything received from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, and no alien passed among them, the wicked man writhes in pain all his days. He's calling Job a wicked man, and the number of years is hidden from the oppressor. Dreadful sounds are in his ears. In prosperity, the destroyer comes upon him. He does not believe that he will return from darkness, for a sword is waiting for him. If he wanders around about for bread, saying, where is it? He knows that a day of darkness is ready at his hand. Trouble and anguish make him afraid. They overpower him like a king ready for battle, for he stretches out his hand against God. And here's some interesting, I'm just going to read 25 and 26. He stretches out his hand against God. He acts defiantly against the Almighty, running stubbornly against him with his strong embossed shield. There's a lot there.
What about 27?
You want me to read that? 27.
Well, I'm going to go back to where you left off anyway, but you can read it. I just like that verse.
27. Though he has covered his... This is what I've got in mind. Though he has covered his face with fatness and made his waist heavy with fat.
Yeah. Actually, in my translation, it says blubber.
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 let me check a few different translations. I'm interested now. I've got I've got bulges. I've got in verse 27 in the NIV, it says, though his face is covered with fat and his waist bulges with flesh. Hey. And hang on. And in my other, I've got a few Bibles open here. We may as well. This one says, his face is covered with fat and his loins. Yeah, I've got blubber. His loins with blubber. That's the Jewish Bible. Blubber. Right. I've never read the word blubber in a Bible before, but there's a first for everything.
Well, now you have. That's why I want you to look up the translations so you can see that idea of blubber. So when we go back to this idea of, it's where we started out with this idea of him, I will declare, I will make known, I will inform you.
Listen, I am the one who knows. Come and drink knowledge from me.
So this is the same verb that we see in chapter 13, verse 17, where he says, you know, you will surely hear my speech and my declaration in your ears. Mm. And so we see that this word in the English that is translated as count actually comes from the root that can mean to measure off, to make a written record, or to write. And we see this in Job chapter 14, verse 16, where it talks about this idea of counting my steps. It talks about this idea. It's this idea of declaring, declaration, counting my steps. And in verse 18, which wise men propose or announce or transmit and have concealed from their fathers, mm-hmm. to them alone was given the land, and no stranger passed amongst them. So I looked at some of the, I wanted to see what I could find about that. There's two main opinions that take place in relation to verse 17 through 19, which we read. Mm-hmm. One is that it speaks of the wise who are generally willing to admit their sin and error and then find themselves richly blessed for their courage. And then the chapter goes on to describe the fate of those who are guilty and yet maintain their innocence.
Mm-hmm.
And the other perspective that's brought usually is that this deals with the issue of what's called a rasha v'tov lo, the perceived tranquility of the wicked, which is, you know, we've seen Job talk about as well, or mm-hmm. early on.
Yeah.
And so moving forward, just translating to go over some of the things, the wicked writhes in agony or torment all his days, and few years are reserved for the ruthless. In verse 21, a voice of dread is in his ears, in peace devastation comes.
Hang on. You've got, sorry, and few years are reserved for the ruthless. That's right. Interesting, because I've got, and the number of years is hidden from the oppressor. So rather than hidden, you've got their reserves.
Yeah,
so
the wicked rise in agony at all his days, and few years are reserved for the ruthless.
I guess that kind of says a similar thing. It just says it the other way around.
Yeah.
But in any case, it's like, your days are numbered, I suppose, is what it's saying, is what Eliphaz is saying.
And in verse 22, when we read, you know, that this idea of he does not trust that he will return from darkness and he is destined for the sword, it actually literally says a sword stares him in the face.
Yay.
Yeah.
A sword is waiting for him. Okay, so it stares him in the face.
Yeah, because basically it comes from a root to keep watch or to keep a lookout. And so basically the whole verse is talking about this idea of the wicked. The wicked always are kind of looking over their shoulder or looking around the corner because they're always expecting something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That something's right around the corner for them.
Yeah, you know? and they know that their day is numbered, is what he's saying.
Right. Mm. He wanders about for bread, saying, where is it that prepared in his hand is the days of darkness. In verse 24, distress and anxiety terrify him, like a king ready for this, you said, battle. Mm-hmm. The Hebrew there is for siege or onslaught, which is similar, but I just like that because it's more pictorial. You know, on the battle, you could think about anything. It could be, it could be out on a battlefield. But when you think of the siege or the onslaught, it usually gives you that picture of the king standing on the battlements of his castle,
mm-hmm.
you know, surrounded by his moat. But yet he sees this vast army in front of him. It's kind of like thinking of, some of the movies that we've seen where this great army is coming and the king just knows. That he's, you know, his castle's not going to be able to withstand the siege or the onslaught.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we have the answer to this. Why? The why of verse 24 is answered in the next couple of verses. It says, because he has stretched out toward God his hand in verse 25, and toward the Almighty played the hero.
Played the hero. I've got, that's fair enough. And acts defiantly against the Almighty or towards the Almighty played the hero. What do you got in 26?
He runs toward him with his neck, with his thickly bossed shield. And this idea of with his neck refers to arrogance. In other words, with his neck, with his head held out or his neck stretched.
Let me jump. You know, this reminds me of Numbers chapter 15, verses 30 and 31. And this is just before the story of the chap that goes out gathering wood on Shabbat. But it says, but the person who does anything presumptuously, whether he is a native born or a stranger, that one brings reproach on Yehovah, and he shall be cut off from among his people because he has despised the word of Yehovah, he has broken his covenant. That person shall be completely cut off. His guilt shall be upon him.
Yeah, and that's always those are great verses. I love talking about that because, you know, of course, people always wonder why did this person, you know, why was this person, cut off? And they forget what you just brought. They forget the point that, you know, Yehovah had just talked about this. He just talked about the person who was, you know, presumptuous about it. And what's the very next thing that we see? We see this guy go out after he heard this, you know, and do exactly what he was not supposed to do.
But does it, now just remind me, because I think, and I'm reading it now, the outstretched arm, what is it? The presumptuous sin, presumptuous. What is, no, okay, okay, what I want to know, Ira, maybe you can remind me, where it says in verse 30, the person who does anything presumptuously, what is it in Hebrew?
Just about there, I'm going to look at it right now.
Numbers 15, verse 30.
Who exalts his hand.
There it is.
Yep. There the Yad Rama. The Yad Rama. It says, V'hanefesh asher ta'aseh b'yad Rama min ha'ezrach. This idea of the soul of the person which makes in his hand exalted, or, you know, it's translated really, it's the idea of acting defiantly.
Defiantly. He raises his fist towards God and says, I'm not going to do it like that. I don't want to do that. I'm going to do what I want to do, despite what you've told me.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a perfect, this is a perfect example of that, in this idea of his running toward him with his neck. It's this idea of this arrogance and with his thickly bossed shield. And just for the idea of, I don't know if people know what a shield boss is. Are you familiar with that?
Well, I'm thinking of a an embossed shield. I'm thinking of something with a sort of an emblem on it. Is that what?
Yeah. Well, shield bosses were basically they were made of thick metal or wood, and they were kind of these, if you've ever seen in some of the movies, these conical kind of shapes. You know, like a pointy right in the center of the shield, this cone like shape that came to a point. That they could use to push off with, and you know, they would use a punching motion, you know, to use as an oncoming blow. You know, just kind of a point so that people understand. So it's almost this a kind of arrogance, like you're running at God with this shield with a point on it, like you're, you know, your neck held high and you're going to attack him. You know, this is what he's being accused of by Eliphaz. And then the blubber verse, that his face is covered with fat blubber upon his loins.
Yeah. What do you make of this verse?
So this verse actually kind of describes the cause of the previous verses. Uh-huh. It's kind of talking about this self-indulgence, which covers him with fat or covers him with blubber. It kind of is this sense of invulnerability, where he can even quarrel against God, that he's so self-indulgent and so arrogant and is so, covered his face with fat and, you know, blubber upon his loins, that that somehow that he could overpower God. We actually see another verse related to the neck that I just saw, actually, in Tehillim, in Psalm 75:5. We see this same word as we see earlier. And actually, the English reads, "Do not exalt your horns to the height to purse a neck of arrogance." And that's speaking to the wicked in Psalm 75. If you look at the context of it, it's speaking of the wicked. Do not exalt your horns to the height to purse a neck of arrogance.
Interesting. And so what I've got just in my study notes here, it says, the imagery of the fat man who eventually loses his wealth and possessions by divine punishment for his wickedness insinuates that Job's calamities have occurred because of his own self-indulgence.
Exactly.
And, yeah. So I think that's well put. And that's, again, what Eliphaz is, it just another blow to Job. Goes on to say he dwells in
distance. So, by the way, I have to tell you, before we go on about that, you know, I don't like these fat jokes, by the way, in the Bible. You know, poor Job. Now not only do we have this idea that he was covered in all this nonsense too, but he was, you know,
he's the butt of fat jokes.
Eliphaz is making it. Yeah, he's the butt of fat jokes too. I mean, you know, I'm a big guy. I don't like that, you know. So.
Okay. Your chair is not squeaking for no reason, right?
Yeah, exactly.
He dwells in the desolate cities, in houses which no one inhabits, which are destined to become ruin. He will not be rich, nor will his wealth continue, nor will his possessions overspread the earth. He will not depart from darkness. The flame will dry out his branches, and by the breath of his mouth he will go away. Let him not trust in futile things, deceiving himself, for futility will be his reward.
Poor Job.
Oh, any kind of hope that Job might have had, any skerrick of hope, he has just ripped out of his hand and put a match to.
Yeah. So in verse 28, we see this, the third Hebrew word there in the verse is this word, nichadot. And it actually has this, it really means to be wiped out. So he dwells in wiped out cities or desolate cities and houses that should not be lived in, which are destined to be a whole heap of stones. And we see two perspectives. There's two opinions on this verse. One is that whatever he touches will eventually be brought to desolation because of his wickedness. Mm-hmm. You know, this is talking of the wicked person. Or the second opinion is that his arrogance is such that he believes he can live and build up that which others consider to be desolate.
Mm-hmm.
So we see two different opinions on this. He will not become rich, nor will his wealth stand, and his acquisition or gain will not stretch out to the ground. Mm-hmm. In other words, the aspirations of the wicked will never be manifest on the earth. He will not turn aside from darkness. His shoot or his offspring will wither by flame, and he turn aside in the breath of his mouth. And so we see that reference to the branch or the shoots again mm-hmm. refers to the family.
Yes.
We saw this before, and Eliphaz is saying that even his children will suffer as a result of the breath of his mouth.
And of course, his children are already gone, but what he's really saying is there's no comeback for you, Job. There's no comeback.
Yeah, there's no comeback. Yeah, the wicked, you know, he will not be trusted. He will err in falsehood because falsehood will be his exchange, is actually what it says there.
Falsehood. I've got futility will be his reward, but falsehood will be his exchange. It will accomplish. It will be accomplished before his time. His branch will not be green. He will shake off his unripe grape like a vine and cast off his blossom like an olive tree. For the company of hypocrites will be barren, and the fire will consume the tents of bribery. Oh, what a... How about this? The company of the hypocrites will be barren, and the fire will consume the tents of bribery. They conceive trouble and bring forth futility. Their womb prepares deceit. That's the way he ends it, with a
yeah,
like dropping a boulder on his head.
Right. So when he tells him that he, you know, back in 31, that because falsehood will be his exchange, he's talking about exchanging something of value for nothing. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those very difficult words to translate. It's translated sometimes as worthless or futile. It could also be translated as magic. I don't know how that works, but that's one of the translations of that word. Mm-hmm. And it really has this idea really of purposeless. And this is one of the other interpretations, that the wicked in life that meander around with no purpose have this purposelessness as their exchange. Mm. That's what it's talking about. This his day will not be filled, and his palm leaf will not be green. He will throw off his unripe grape like vine, and will cast off the flower like the olive tree that you talk again. And so again, we have this reference to the offspring of the wicked.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, those verses you said, for the company of the godless is barren, and fire consumes the tents of the corrupt. They have conceived mischief, given birth to iniquity, and their womb prepares deception. Is that what you had?
That's what I've got. Their womb prepares deceit. So thanks very much, Eliphaz. That's Eliphaz round two. And we have to leave it there because we've really gone over our time. But
yeah, do you have any friends like that, Jonah? By the way,
man, they wouldn't last long in my as acquaintances
really?
Of mine. You know, and this is what I think. You know, I think these guys. I don't know that I'd call them friends. I guess maybe they're acquaintances. Maybe a better word for them is peers. I think we could all agree that they are peers of contemporaries of Job. As far as Job's status was concerned, they are of a similar status, and therefore they feel they have the right to go and gloat as the victorious ones, and bask in the demise of Job because it makes them feel superior. I really think that's what's going on. I don't know that I would call them friends. I would say I would call them peers or contemporaries.
Yeah. And you know what's funny about that is I just, when I was doing another radio show the other day, we talked about this. And I'm going to say something very controversial for the listeners, and I hope you don't edit this out. But we could all learn something from this, because I have to tell you, in all the years that I've interacted with many communities, I've interacted with the Christian community, I have interacted with the Messianic community, I've interacted with the Hebrew Roots community, and I have to tell you, I've never met more vicious and cruel people in my entire life.
There you go. There it is.
I'm just calling it like it is, folks. And so, you know, something that we all need to learn. And, you know, and this is significant going back to those verses that we talked about earlier, you know, related to, looking at the holy ones and so forth. You know, there's something that separates us out, you know, Jonah, between the animals and between even the Malachim. Mm-hmm. And we read that in the Torah portions in Bereshit and in Noah. This idea that in the creation of man, that man was given the Nishmat Chaim, he was given this breath of life. And then we see that in Noah, when God destroys the earth, he says that even all of those who had a Nishmat Ruach Chaim, the breath of the spirit of life in them, were destroyed. This is the thing, you know, the nefesh, the soul, is the thing that keeps us connected to the animal, the animalistic world. This idea of connecting to our physical existence, our lust, our thirst, our hunger, all of those things. But we've been given something different. We've been given a neshama. Okay, we've been given the breath of life that God breathed into us, and that's the thing that separates us out. That's the thing that draws us towards a relationship with God. That's the thing that draws us towards wanting to have a relationship with God. Mm-hmm. And people need to start elevating themselves out of the nefesh and into the neshama, so that they don't act like the Eliphazes, the Bildads, and the Tzofars when their friends are in trouble.
Amen. Amen. And boy, oh boy, you and I, we would like to elaborate on what you've just said with examples, because
well,
there's so many of recent, in recent weeks, there's a plethora of examples, but we won't go there. And I think that's probably a good place to leave it. So sure. Ira Michelson, my friend, Torah teacher, Treasures from the Tanakh is the Facebook page. And let me just encourage all the listeners, if you're on Facebook, find it, get on it, like it, and interact with the information there, Treasures from the Tanakh, because it's not just this program that Ira does. He does other things as well, and he posts them there that you can indulge in and engage in. So, my friend, thank you once again for your time. I'm looking forward to getting into verse 16 and 17 next time we speak, when Job manages to step back into the ring.
Thanks so much. Yeah, it's going to be fun getting into that. Thanks so much for having me again, Jonah.
It's always a pleasure to have you, my friend. And until next week, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.